Officials in Vietnam appear to have latched onto a new strategy for silencing dissent online by bulk reporting some users' Facebook profiles as abusive to have them removed. In Myanmar, netizens and public officials are wrestling with the thorny issue of what constitutes online hate speech. And societies across Asia are taking cues from the US and the UK by using the fight against cybercrime to pass restrictive laws that are often applied to silence inconvenient speech on the internet. In this week's Asia Digital Life podcast, I talk with Gillian York, Director for International Freedom of Expression at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Gillian was in Melbourne for a series of conferences, and I managed to steal her away for a wide-ranging conversation about all of this and more. Gillian, thanks so much for joining us today.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about Vietnam. I know that you've been studying internet culture in Vietnam, particularly as it relates to internet freedom. What's going on these days?
Sure. So, you know, we've heard over the past few years a number of bloggers, journalists being detained or tried, even sometimes imprisoned for seemingly spurious charges because their blogging or their speech constitutes a challenge to the state. So a great example of this is the case of Lê Quốc Quan, who was imprisoned for charges completely unrelated to his speech. But, you know, all of the advocacy that I've seen around this case demonstrates to me that it's very clear that it's the things that he was saying, speaking out against on his blog that got him into hot water.
The breadth of things that can be considered threatening to the state is very, very broad in Vietnam. And so how has that been handled?
So in that case, I'm not going to be able to remember the details off the top of my head because we do work on a lot of cases all over the world.
Sure.
But in this case, my understanding is that he has been convicted, that there's still another attempt for appeal, if I'm remembering correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, you know, it's he was not prosecuted for his speech, though. He was prosecuted for other charges, unrelated charges.
Right. Now, ever since last year, I think it was late last year, September last year, Decree 72 in Vietnam made a lot of news headlines for what it seemed at the time the decree was meant to forbid social media users in Vietnam from sharing anything related to news or to current events or certainly political topics, but it seemed to forbid the sharing of news in Vietnam.
Yeah, I'm not terribly familiar with that particular decree. I know I've read about it. But you know, that's something that we're seeing all over the world, really, that sort of restriction. Most commonly, I would say, in like the Gulf states in the Middle East, mm-hmm. that's the kind of thing where the laws are written as such, and that's what I think is happening in this case, where the laws are written as such to seemingly, you know, prevent incitement from being shared, or to prevent blasphemy in the case of some of these Middle Eastern countries from being shared, but really has the overbroad effect of prohibiting various types of content from being shared, or at least creating the sense of risk for people who want to share that content. And actually, I mean, Cambodia's cybercrime draft has a really similar provision in it.
Yeah, now that draft is pending at the moment, is that correct?
Yes, yes.
And what would that do? Now, these are laws that are ostensibly aimed at preventing cybercrime or the use of these social media tools by bad people, really bad people, terrorists and criminals and hackers and identity thieves. But they're being written in a way that allows them to have a much broader application. Is that correct?
Yeah. And I would say, I mean, honestly, that's really, again, it's true of what's happening all over the world, where in the interest of national security, governments are creating provisions that allow them to, you know, that are ostensibly, again, for prosecuting the really bad guys, the terrorists, but are vague enough that if somebody else is doing something they don't like, they can prosecute them under that. And I mean, the UK is kind of the perfect example of this, with looking at charging journalists under terrorism laws for sharing or for publishing content. I mean, actually Australia as well. Just the other day, I read something about new provisions to prosecute whistleblowers, which is one thing. But then on top of that, journalists for publishing content that whistleblowers give them. So they want to use terrorism laws to go after journalists who are just doing their job,
yeah.
Which is, you know, if once the documents are out, then journalists have to do their job. It's in the public interest.
Right. And this is, of course, a discouraging trend that's been going on since 9/11. The use of, you drop the word terrorism and suddenly, you know, all kinds of doors, legal channels open to you that weren't mm-hmm. open before you started invoking that specter. And it seems a lot of countries, unfortunately, you know, America kind of pioneered this tactic in a lot of other countries. China certainly is doing the same thing right now.
It's exactly the same way. It's no coincidence that we're seeing, you know, I mean, Cambodia has a cybercrime draft law. The Philippines had a cybercrime draft law. Vietnam has this article that they're looking at. And this is, you know, this is happening in lots of other parts of the world. Iraq has a cybercrime draft law. I mean, talk about priorities. And I say that because not only are they also battling genuine terrorists, but they also only have internet penetration of about 1.7%. And that's, you know, true in many of these cases. Cambodia's internet penetration is also quite low compared to, say, Vietnam's or the Philippines. And yet, for some reason, cybercrime is a priority. And to me, you know, it suggests that they're taking the lead from Western countries. And the same goes for copyright provisions, too. A lot of the Southeast Asian countries that have been looking into signing these trade agreements are doing it for economic advantages. At the same time, they have an incredibly detrimental effect on people, especially, you know, when it comes to copyright, especially because it drives up prices beyond people's reach for content.
Singapore just passed, basically SOPA is what Singapore just passed.
Yeah, I'm not as up to date on that one, to be perfectly honest, but it doesn't surprise me either.
And what I find interesting is not that it was passed, because, you know, obviously Singapore and the U.S. are two very different cultural political systems, but that it passed so easily and with so little opposition. Nobody said anything. I was looking carefully at this, and there was almost no blowback whatsoever from this.
Well, I think a lot of times it's a lack of understanding. I mean, the reason that SOPA got so much blowback was because there were a few core activist organizations, mine included, that came together, organized around creating this day of blackout, and then because they had great connections, I mean, everybody, you know, there was a lot of talk that the SOPA protests in the U.S. were led by Google or led by corporations, and that's just simply not true. But at the same time, these activist organizations had good connections to the policy folks at Google or to Jimmy Wales at Wikimedia and were able to get those larger organizations to sign on and do something about it. And I think that that's, you know, that's where it's difficult to make that same kind of change happen elsewhere. I mean, if you talk about the SOPA-style blackout protests, Philippines, they did the same thing to, to protest the cybercrime law. Jordan, they did that to protest the press and publications law. And Lebanon is the only one of those three that was successful in protesting their similar act, the Lebanese Internet Regulation Act. And it really depends on that context with activists. Do you have strong organizations that have the connections within the media and within politics? And in the Philippines, I mean, I think that's actually a fascinating case as well. There, I saw a lot of content coming out of there, and that's how I got involved in it. I follow a couple of Filipino journalists, and they were following it really, really closely, the opposition to that Cybercrime Act. And so I started to look into it a little bit, and it turns out that, again, they do. They've got a couple of great senators there? I'm getting my political systems mixed up. But a couple of great representatives who were willing to push that forward.
Before you and I started talking here, we were having a conversation back to Vietnam, and we were talking about one of the new ways that the Vietnamese government appears to be clamping down on dissent without a lot of the other tools they have that, for example, China has. Vietnam has no great firewall such as that, but they're getting a little bit more tactical. Could you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, so, you know, most countries aren't as sophisticated as China. I think that China and to a slightly lesser degree, Iran are really exceptions when it comes to that cat and mouse game between internet users and governments. But one thing that China pioneered was the 50 Cent Army, which is basically, you know, these paid commenters who they're paid by the state to go and try to manipulate public opinion through commenting on blogs or using social media, Weibo, whatever. And we saw other countries start to follow China. So a couple of the ones that I've documented are Israel, Syria, and Bahrain. But another interesting thread to that, which I think I was about to mention earlier, was that sometime in the mid-2000s, the U.S. State Department actually funded a small division of people to comment on Arabic, Farsi, and Urdu blogs and try to manipulate opinion on those. Now, the only difference between them and China on this is that they signed that they worked for the State Department, so they were being transparent about it. But at the same time, I think that there's real questions around the role of the state in this sort of thing. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's another way of targeting people. It's a way of trying, I think it's often a way of trying to silence people. And in fact, in the U.S. case, even though they said very clearly in their documentation that the purpose of this was solely to go after extremists and terrorists. There was a case in which one of these folks kind of went rogue and started commenting on a fairly, you know, peaceful, nonviolent Palestinian blog. And so this guy, you know, he had very strong opinions. He was completely against everything that the U.S. was doing, saying, you know, stop funding Israel, all of that. But that does not constitute terrorism or extremism.
Right.
It's just a strong political opinion.
Yeah.
And you had a State Department guy commenting on that. And so I think that the just the...
But was he on the clock?
Well, he was signing his name with the State Department bit. I mean, yeah, right. No. Well, actually, that's, you know, that's a good question, too, because we've also seen some of these governments, and I think to bring it back to Asia, some of these governments doing this on Wikipedia as well, editing posts. I mean, we saw the Russian government do it last week with the Malaysian plane, and I believe that there are a number of instances where China's been documented doing this as well.
Well, China's, you know, gone so far as to create their own Wikipedia.
Yeah.
They say, the heck, it's too much trouble to go back and change Wikipedia all the time. We'll just ban Wikipedia and create our own, which, you know, it includes all of our own version of our history.
Which is such a fascinating model, because China's really the only country that has created strong enough alternatives that make people not break through that fear barrier to access the blocked content. I mean, I know some people do, but the vast majority... I don't want to say they're satisfied with it, but they have good places to build community and make friends.
Yeah.
And so if, you know, that combined with all the other methods of state control, people are satisfied. I think the reason that people are willing to circumvent censorship in most places in the world is because they don't have those alternatives available.
You saw a little bit of conversation about this regarding the Google blot recently in China. You know, right around the anniversary, the 25th anniversary of Tiananmen, they really clamped down on Google and all Google platforms so that they were totally unavailable to anybody in mainland China. And a lot of scholars were talking about this, saying, look, there are some things that Google does and Google platforms do that we simply cannot get with any of the available Chinese alternatives. Mm-hmm. And they said, this is going to be bad for China's economy. It's going to be bad for the academic community. It's bad for business in so many ways. And then we saw that block on all the Chinese, on the Google platforms lifted a little bit. I wouldn't say, you know, Google's obviously not wide open there, but it was lifted a little bit in the past week or so.
Google's really hard to block. So... for years, Iranians were using Google Reader to access blocked websites because you can put an RSS feed through Google Reader. And because Google Reader, or because Google uses SSL across all of their sites, it's very difficult to block one site and not the other. I'm not even sure China's capable of doing it. I haven't followed closely enough how they're doing these blocks. But basically, the idea was that if you block Google Reader, you have to block the whole Google platform. And so Iranians were using Google Reader to get around these blocks. And, you know, the government wanted to block Google, but they knew they couldn't, because even some, you know, even some Iranian officials were undoubtedly relying on Google.
Right.
And so that put them in a really tough spot. And then when Google Reader went down, there were all these protests from Iranians going like, really? You don't care about us. And I think that says a lot more about Google and their direction.
You mean when Google discontinued the
user when they discontinued Google Reader. You know, I mean, we talked to them directly about it and they said, sorry. Which, I mean, you know, it's not being evil, but it's certainly not thinking about their users very much either.
Yeah. So back to Vietnam briefly.
Yes.
The use of this Vietnamese pro-government little army of commenters, how is that being used in Vietnam?
Well, so one of the things that we've seen recently is Facebook pages going down. And it's not clear who's doing this, but I'm going to pull this back a second and say that, you know, I've written about this for years, and I'm actually about to launch a project around it called OnlineCensorship.org. And basically the issue is that for years we've seen people try to manipulate Facebook's user-generated content policing system. So basically, if you find a post on Facebook that you don't like, you can report it. It gives you a number of different options, harassment, spam, whatever. And
hate speech,
exactly. And then Facebook has staff that look at those reports and determine whether it's a positive or a false, an accurate report or a not accurate report.
Mm-hmm.
And then if it is, then they take it down. And you know, there have been a lot of issues around how the amount of time that Facebook staff actually have to look at that. We've heard former Facebook staffers say that they literally are supposed to do it in about half a second. And so you're looking at something that's hate speech or not and making that split second decision. And so, I mean, I could talk all day about that, but I'll bring it back to Vietnam and say that one of the things that we've seen is just bulk groups of accounts, people associated with each other, going down at once. And it's very clear that this is based on malicious reporting. Mm. Now, it's hard to not blame Facebook for this, because I don't think that their rules are reasonable in the first place, which is why I'm launching this project. But at the same time, you know, what ends up happening is that if the people doing the reporting are sophisticated enough, they can find, you know, reasons to report somebody that is difficult to appeal or refute. So an example of this would be if you report somebody as being underage, which is under the age of 13, U.S. law called COPA, the Child Online Protection Act, means that you have to be over 13 to use these sites.
And these are Facebook's own regulations and rules.
That one's based on law. Okay. So, I mean, it's not that you have to be 13 to use them. It's the way it's written has to do with advertising. But basically, Facebook adheres to that. So okay. You have to be 13 to use Facebook. So if you're not, I mean, if Facebook believes that you're underage, they'll ask you to prove that you're not, which means submitting your ID. Now, they do this with I'm putting finger quotes right now, real names as well. They require you to use your real name, which for them means the name on your birth certificate.
Right.
Which is really problematic when you think about...
some of these dissidents.
Well, but also even just people from China who live in the U.S. and use a Western-sounding name. Michael Ante has had his Facebook page go down. The journalist Michael Ante. He's had his Facebook page go down in the past because they said, sorry, your name's not really Michael Ante. And he said, well, the New York Times accepted it. Why won't you? And so basically what ends up happening is, dissidents, they don't want to submit their ID, and nor should they. It's not a very secure method of proving who you are.
Right.
There's huge security risk there. How long is Facebook storing these? What are they doing with them? Are they handing them over to the NSA?
Mm-hmm. So we're finding that the pages, personal pages of a lot of dissidents, maybe associated with Viet Thanh and other pro-democracy movements in Vietnam, are disappearing because... they're targeting these pages with a version of DDoS. It's not DDoS,
but it's like it. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, again, like I've seen this happen in Hong Kong. I've seen it happen in Israel and Palestine. I've seen it happen in a number of places. But this seems to be at a scale or at a speed that I just haven't seen before. The number of pages going down, or personal pages or personal accounts going down at once is just unbelievable.
We could have a continued conversation about Vietnam. It's fascinating, the really unique way in which Facebook works inside the Vietnamese system, because it's obviously not blocked the way it is in China, and they are still very interesting. I had a great conversation about this with Adam Lin with the Open Technology Fund a few weeks ago. But in the interest of time, let's switch over to talking about somewhere else in Asia that I know you have looked at a little bit recently, and that's Myanmar.
Yeah. So I had the good fortune to be invited to speak at the East-West Center's Freedom of the Press Conference in March, which was held in Myanmar for the first time. And, you know, I got to see Aung San Suu Kyi speak. I got to meet some formerly imprisoned bloggers under the previous regime. It was really incredible. But really the hot topic at the time was, what do we do about the hate speech? And so Facebook in Myanmar is... you know, it sounds to me from what you've said that it's kind of parallel to how it's being used in Vietnam. It's if you're a business and, you know, you have a little printing shop or a small tech company, instead of making a website, you just have a Facebook page. So Facebook almost is the internet. And what that means is that it's really the sort of centralized platform that everybody's using. And given the conflict that's happening in Myanmar between Buddhists and the Rohingya Muslim community, essentially, it sounds to me as though there's a lot of incitement on Facebook. Again, a lot of it's in the Burmese language, so I can't parse it. But there's a lot of incitement against the Muslim community. And so the discussion that's being had is, first off, what to do about this. Nobody really wants to go back to the level of censorship that they had before. But this full openness doesn't seem to really be working well either. Facebook is not doing anything about it. They probably only have one or two Burmese speakers on staff, I'm guessing. And then on top of that, you know, there's also, I mean, even Aung San Suu Kyi, I was not impressed with her answers around what to do about this, what the responsibility of people is. I mean, she was talking a lot about personal responsibility, but nobody was really differentiating between hate speech and incitement until I was on a panel with Nathan Lat, one of the bloggers who was imprisoned until 2012, I believe, and then let go during that period of amnesty. And he was saying that's really the most pressing question right now in terms of speech, is making the distinction between hate speech and incitement to violence, and getting people to understand, you know, sort of getting a sense of tolerance for mm-hmm. trashy speech mm-hmm. While taking incitement very seriously.
That's one, I find that's one of the really interesting questions about lots of Asian societies, is that exactly that question of the difference between hate speech and incitement. Because a lot of speech that we might find in a place like the US or Canada or the UK would be relative, people would shrug it off. Mm-hmm. People would not be, you wouldn't expect people to be rioting over that kind of speech. But there's a much more wariness about that kind of speech in many Asian societies, because they literally do fear people rioting over that kind of speech. Things that would not cause that much of an outcry in maybe a more Western context, over here, very often in places like India, Singapore, these multicultural places with, you know, several different religions there, there is a real fear that religious tension could be sparked into, you know, violence by a lot of this talk.
Yeah, Sharian George from Singapore has actually done a lot of really interesting work on this. And I you know, he's got this great blog post. I wish I could pull it up right now, but it's basically where he kind of looks at the Western way of, or Western, so to speak, way of dealing with hate speech versus the way a lot of Asian societies deal with hate speech. And when I read it, you know, I kind of looked at this little chart that he made and said, wow, that's exactly true for the Middle East as well. And so I think it has a lot to do with the homogeneity of society. Where, you know, when you've got, it's not, so, I actually don't even think it's so much about multiculturalism, because, you know, a lot of these Western societies are multicultural too, in a different way. It's when you've got societies that have been more closed off, and so they may be multi-religious or multi-ethnic, but they're all, you know, but people have been there for a long time. And so these tensions have just had so long to inflame, and nobody else has been coming in to kind of break that up. And I think that, you know, I think it's clear to me that speech can be more dangerous in those places, but I have a really hard time with the idea that censorship is the answer to that, because I don't think that it fixes the societal ills that lie underneath. And the fact is, no matter how long a society has been closed off or semi-closed off, they're not anymore. We're living in a globalized time, and I think that as a world, we have to be solving, I don't think we can be solving these problems at the nation state level. I think we need to be solving them at the global level.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that your idea on that is that the problem with bad speech or hate speech or inflammatory speech, you know, it's often said, certainly in the U.S., that the solution to that kind of speech is almost always more speech, not less. Is that a fair...
Yeah, I do believe that, but I think that has its limitations as well. I mean, I think that, you know, I mean, John Stewart did a great little bit the other night on Israel and Palestine, where he said, you know, the reaction, basically he started talking about one or the other, and he would have either Palestinians or Israelis shouting in his ears. And that's true, that conflict has a lot of more speech answers to it, but it doesn't make it go anywhere. Mm. And so, yeah, I think that when you...
And that's one of the problems with the internet, isn't it? That sometimes yeah. there's so much speech out there that it's simply not intelligible or articulate or managed in a way that makes it do what it ought to be doing.
Yeah, you know, I was at ANU at Canberra a couple days ago, and a scholar there in the Middle East, Jackie Sutton, said that, you know, she thought that she'd read something about I think it's only 7% of our communications are verbal, and the rest of them are around body language, tone, things like that. And so you're taking 7% of our full capacity, having that dialogue. I mean, now I want to write a thesis on this. Like, I heard that fact and said, damn, that's exactly it. Mm. Because if you think about that, then, you know, there's just no context around what you're saying. You can put a little emoji in there, and those are really interesting as a concept. I hope somebody does a dissertation on emoji.
I'm sure somebody's working on it right now.
Yes. but you know, basically you're dealing with speech out of context. And, you know, I mean, I think there's that. I think also just the limitations of these platforms in terms of length of speech is really problematic. But, you know, I mean, back to that question that you'd asked before, I think ultimately more speech is the answer. It's a better answer than censorship. But at the same time, I think that we have to be asking big societal questions that we're not asking right now, about what a world looks like where everybody from, you know, where I can communicate with somebody in Singapore, Vietnam, and Australia at the same time. What does that mean for the world? And what does it mean for speech? Because they might have you know, stronger cultural limitations on speech than I do. But I think we have to find somewhere that we're meeting in the middle. And while I tend to look at the American model as ideal, I recognize that maybe the ideal is actually more like what the EU, how the EU views speech.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a whole separate conversation, especially regarding what's happening over there with Google and all of that recently. But
yes,
I'd love to have that conversation. Maybe we'll save it for another time, because there are Asian societies that have been looking. They say, hey, if you can do this for Europe, then why can't you do it in Hong Kong? Why can't you do it in South Korea? So that's a really interesting conversation I'd love to have. However, we need to wrap this up. As much as I'd like to keep talking, Jillian, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Where can we follow what you're doing with the Electronic Frontier Foundation?
Sure. So my organization is EFF.org. And if you want to look at some of the stuff that I'm writing or blogging about, that's Jillian C. York, Jillian with a J.com.
Fantastic. And of course, anyone who wants to follow what we're doing at the Asia Digital Life Project can do that at a number of places. The good place to start, if you want to have anything to say about this, which I hope you will do, come talk to us at facebook.com/AsiaDigitalLife. If you're a Google Plus user, you can use that. Bless you. You can find us at google.com/+AsiaDigitalLife. Ignore the crickets that are chirping on that page. I'm posting to it every day regardless. The best place to follow what I'm doing is on my Twitter feed at psharbaugh. That's P-S-H-A-R-B-A-U-G-H. And of course, the best place to find these podcasts for now is either on my Facebook page or at SoundCloud. And that's soundcloud.com/AsiaDigitalLife. Jillian, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure. Everybody, keep it tuned. We'll be back soon.